The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 229.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey guys, hope you are well. Welcome to tonight's live streams in Fort Myers, Florida. I spent Friday and Saturday and most of today in West Palm Beach hanging out with my good buddies, Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy. And today I had lunch with another good friend, someone that you guys might know. His name is Jeff Snyder. And Jeff and I sat there and had an incredible conversation. I don't think Jeff is watching this live stream, but my thanks go out to Jeff for taking time out of his schedule to meet me for lunch. We had a great food and great conversation. And of course, as you can imagine, we started talking about the Fed and quantitative easing and inflation and deflation, and the global monetary system. And if you could have been a fly on that wall, you guys would have definitely learned a lot. I know I did. So that was such a neat experience. But all three of those guys are going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live. Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy, and Jeff Snyder, and me. So if you guys haven't gotten your tickets for Rebel Capitalist Live, that's the live conference, investment conference I'm doing in Miami, June 11th through the 13th. And it's not on Skype. It's not on Zoom. When I mean live, I mean face-to-face people. You can actually meet other human beings, other Rebel Capitalists. So we're capping it right around 500 tickets because that's the space I have. Right now, we're at about 350 tickets sold. So if you want to get your tickets, make sure you do that sooner than later. It's at rebelcapitalistlive.com. Oh, and I just confirmed another person that's going to be speaking that isn't even up on the page yet. And he is someone that you guys will definitely know. I can't say any more than that. Look out. You'll see him up on the webpage sooner than later. But you guys will, those of you who've purchased tickets and will purchase tickets or are going to the event, this is going to completely blow your mind. You guys are really going to be excited once we announce this speaker. I just spoke to him actually on the drive over. Okay, let's get into your questions. Velocity, is it all-time lows? Do you see it coming back to historical average or continue to head lower? Velocity is the key to inflation, deflation, in my opinion. Velocity is a way to measure what's happening in the underlying economy. So I don't know if velocity in and of itself is key. I mean, I guess that's one way of just saying that it's showing you what's happening in the underlying economy. But you got to think this through a little bit, because let's say that we had velocity to go down. Okay, well, if you had velocity go down, but if you had the amount of goods and services that are in the economy go down even faster, the price for those goods and services that were still available could go up massively, right? So if we have half the goods and services today, or excuse me, in a year than we have right now, and velocity goes down and money supply increases, you can still have consumer price inflation, even though velocity is going down. It depends on what's happening to goods and services. Now, if you have the same amount of goods and services and you have the same amount of money circulating in the system and you have velocity that goes lower, then yeah, it's going to be deflationary. But it's all, you know, you got to take things to their extreme. And let's just say that the only thing available in the United States for sale was one house. Okay. And that was it. That was the only good or service that was for sale in the United States. Well, velocity would go down because GDP, nominal GDP, would go from, call it $22 trillion, down to whatever someone is willing to, or the bidders are willing to pay on the house. So say that would, anyone who wants a house, that's the only one available. So the, let's say it's a $100,000 house, it would go up to like, who knows, $100 million for that one house, because the bids go so high. But GDP goes down to 100 million, and the one transaction that has occurred, prices went up dramatically. So you'd have, again, not the way that the CPI is measured, because it's a rent adjusted equivalent, but just assuming that home prices were in the CPI measurement, then you would have massive inflation, but yet velocity would absolutely plummet, would crash. Now, money supply would most likely crash too, but you see what I'm saying? It's not just as simple as, well, velocity goes up. A lot of people just get super focused on the supply of currency units, the demand side of the equation, and velocity or nominal GDP or something like that. And they kind of forget about the supply side. And because we haven't had, we don't even know what supply shocks are like in the United States, because we really haven't seen anything like that since maybe the early 1970s. But we're obviously, we saw it in 2020. And in my opinion, you're seeing it now. Just the other night, Friday, when I was driving out to see Hartman, and Ken flew out there from Dallas. Ken was in West Palm this weekend doing a speaking engagement for Tony Robbins. So it just so happened that the three of us were there at the same time. And Snyder actually lives in West Palm. So that's how we all kind of connected this weekend. But Hartman was grabbing reservations for us Friday night. And he called me on the drive out there. And he says, dude, I've been trying to call places for literally an hour and no one has reservations. You cannot get reservations anywhere. There's just zero reservations. So I know this gal out in West Palm. It's like one of these VIP hostesses or whatever. And she knows a lot of guys that own restaurants and other establishments like nightclubs and stuff like that in West Palm. And she was able to get us a reservation at some Michael Jordan, something like Thousand North. It was a really great place. I like to give them a plug because the food is fantastic. But you get my point. Is the and then we couldn't get an Uber. Same thing that I've been bitching about in Tucson. It's just impossible to get an Uber. So the you see right in front of your eyes the amount of goods and services shrinking and deteriorating. Now, will that come back? Not if the government continues to do what they're doing and paying people to stay home and de-incentivizing productivity and just continue to send people checks so the income levels go up, and then decrease everyone's expenses by 33% because you're not making them pay their rent or their mortgage. And then you put all these restrictions on businesses. You made half of them go out of business in 2020 by making them shut down. I'm exaggerating, obviously, with half, but you guys get my point. So anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on that question, but there's a lot of nuance in it's not as easy as just velocity when you're thinking about inflation, deflation. And I had a conversation with Snyder today, and it got pretty I would say high level. And this debate is not as simple as just the money the government is creating and spending into the economy. And you've got to think through euro dollar market. You've got to think through, you've got to go back like 50, 60 years to really figure this stuff out. You got to go through Bretton Woods. It's not just as easy as say, oh, well, the government's going to do UBI, therefore we're going to get inflation. It's just a no-brainer. It's not a no-brainer. I wish you guys could have heard that conversation between Jeff and I, and you'd know what I'm talking about. Oh, I mean, I'll interview Jeff for the channel within the next month or so, and we'll kind of revisit that conversation we had, because I think all of you guys would really enjoy it. What do you see happening that would allow the Fed to change course quickly and raise rates? How would inflation have to reach that? That's not going to happen, Harry. I don't know how they could raise rates. You've got to remember that the government rolls over about now probably 11 or 12 trillion dollars a year in debt. So even though they have a 27, let's say 28, 29 trillion in debt, that's not like a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Think about this. What if your mortgage that you have in your house right now adjusted every year? You'd be pretty darn worried about interest rates. And let's just assume that you can barely afford your payment right now at a 3% interest rate. Well, what happens if next year interest rates go up to 4%? You got big problems. The government's in the exact same position. Now, sure, they could go ahead and print the money. I'm not saying they're going to default or anything like that. But if we're in an inflationary mode, assuming we go that direction like the 1970s, that's the kryptonite for the Fed and the government, because they can't. Just think about it this way. Go back to the late 70s, if you guys were living at that time, and think about 77, 78, 79. Think about what would have happened if the government would say, stimulus package? No problem. Let's just print up $4 trillion and spend it into the market. UBI? Hey, I got you. No problemo. Or if you're talking about the interest rate on the debt, no problem. Interest rates go from 2% to 4% to 8%. You think all the MMT people then would just say, who cares? The government is a currency issuer. They're not a currency user. Think about that argument back in the late 1970s. Ain't gonna happen. So that oddly enough, that inflation that they're trying to achieve is their kryptonite. It's just at what degree, or if we have it in the first place. So let me make sure I'm. Yeah, my point is, I don't think they can let rates get. So I think the better question is, how high can rates get before they start pegging the yield curve or attempting to peg the yield curve? And I don't think they can raise rates in the short term. I mean, they can, but I think it's very low probability, because that would have some severe impacts. Where do banks exchange U.S. dollars deposited by exporters to the U.S.? Do they use regular Forex market, or is this? Let's see. Where do banks exchange U.S. dollars deposited by exporters to the U.S.? So if someone's exporting, I'm not quite sure what your question is. So Business A just is in Australia, and they sell a bunch of services or goods in dollars. They get the dollars, but they need Aussie dollars to pay their employees. So they go down to their local bank, they exchange it. Most likely in Australia, they have a multi-currency account. That's pretty common. And let's see. So where do those dollars come from? That would be most likely the central bank. Do they use regular Forex market? And just exchange? I don't know. I'm not quite sure exactly how that plumbing works. I'm under the impression that it would go to the central bank, and then the central bank, let's see here. That would be, I think that transaction goes to the central bank. I haven't studied that. So I'm not sure. That's just the first thing that pops into my mind. Detached home with legal suit in Canada and Saskatchewan province. Price, detached home with legal suit. Price 455, 20% down. 5 years at, no. Adam, those are terrible numbers. Those would be terrible numbers without a legal suit.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
George Gammon, both precious metals matter, formed a cup. Okay, technical stuff. Do you think there will be more spoofing the metals, Rainbow? I don't know, Joker. You're trying to figure out the price direction, and I never do that. I don't like to try to figure out price directions on assets. I don't have an edge on that at all. So the only edge I have is just buying when other people don't want to buy it and just trying to ask myself if it's cheap or expensive. And right now, no one wants to buy gold, so I'd buy. And I think it's pretty cheap when you look at a historic chart adjusted for inflation, but then look at its competitor, the money supply, M2. If you think M2 is accurate, I mean, Jeff and I had a long conversation. He doesn't think it's accurate, and it definitely does not depict the dollar supply. That's for sure. Now, how much of the dollar supply does it actually reflect? Who knows? Is it 90%? Is it 10%? I don't know. Because the euro dollar market exists in the shadows. And one thing Snyder and I were talking about is how useful it is. And I got to give him all the credit because he was doing this when I first started listening to him, is to, instead of use the word money or currency, just use the word bank liability, because that's really what you're talking about. So M2 is just a measurement of bank liabilities, commercial bank liabilities, right? But there's a lot of those dollar-denominated bank liabilities that are outside of the United States and outside of the system. And Snyder would argue way, 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 way more outside of the system in the shadows that we just really can't measure. So, you know, Jeff's main thing with deflation is you got to look at what the bond market is telling you. You got to look at the bond market. And then everyone would say, well, that's because the Fed is buying the long end of the curve, right? I mean, I know it's gone up recently as far as rates, but not to the extent that it would if the market was predicting 1970s type of inflation. And people would say, well, that's because the Fed's bringing down the yield curve because they're creating artificial demand for those bonds, which makes the prices go higher. And the rates go lower than they otherwise would be. But Snyder, when I was talking to him at lunch today, he made a great point. And it's a point I've actually made on a lot of my whiteboard videos. He used my own point against me. He says, listen, the Fed tried to, when the Fed did QE 1 and 2 and 3, what happened to interest rates on the long end of the curve? They went up. They didn't go down. So if the Fed creates all of this excess demand that just completely moves the market, well, then how the hell did interest rates go up every single time they did QE 1, 2, and 3? That's a great question. Think about what QE is. It's the Fed attempting to bring down the long end of the curve. So every time they tried to do it, the long end of the curve didn't go down. It went up when they were creating more demand for those treasuries by creating bank reserves. So why should we believe that this massive amount of demand that's being created isn't just pissing into the wind. And even people like me say, well, shoot, sure, the interest rates on the 10-year at 1.6, but the Fed wasn't buying. They'd be at 3, 4, 5%, which would the market be, then the bond market would be telling you that they're predicting inflation. But I don't know. I mean, every time the Fed does something, the market does the complete opposite of what the Fed wants it to do or thinks it should do. Maybe not what they want it to do, but thinks it should do. And so maybe if they're trying to peg the yield curve, that rates will just go higher. Who knows? We live in such a crazy world. I mean, the pushback there from like Grohman or something would be, well, QE was just doing a set amount. So we're going to do $80 billion a month, as an example. Or right now they're doing like $120 a month. I think they're doing like $80 in treasuries and like $40 in mortgage-backed securities. Where Snyder would come in, and Lynn would probably say this as well. If they do yield curve control, it's not an 80, a set number per month. It's limitless per month. It's however many we need to buy to make sure the rates don't go above 2%, 2.5%, or wherever they are trying to peg it. And so that's, I think, the pushback. That would be the kind of the debate between two sides there. And I don't know how the heck I got off on that tangent, but hi, George, I'm sending you stories on Twitter about what's happening in Canada. We have police checkpoints in Ontario. The feds want to institute EBI. How do we get out if employed? Wow. Man, Arnold, I'm sorry, my friend. That's just terrible, 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 terrible. I mean, at what point is it going to dawn on people that number one, stuff like that does not work, and number two, that it's just what are we doing here, guys? I mean, don't people in Canada or XYZ place look at YouTube? Don't they look at the internet? Don't they? I would challenge any Canadian to come to Florida. I know you probably can't without quarantining for 8 years, but you get my point. Come down. If you think all of these measures work and you think that they're absolutely necessary, or else we would have massive, unprecedented death and destruction throughout the entire world, I would challenge you to come to Florida, where I am right now, Fort Myers, or even West Palm. And West Palm was kind of a little, you know, they were a little more compliant there with the mask. I shouldn't say compliant, because I don't think it was a law there. I'm not sure. But there are a lot more people wearing masks, bottom line. You get out here to Fort Myers, nobody. Nobody. And they just... So how is it that a place that has like zero compliance, like the places I've been in Florida, how is it that their hospitals aren't overrun? How is it that there's not, I mean, I just drove up into my hotel. How come there's not body bags just lining the streets? How is that possible? I mean, if you listen to the mainstream media, that's what would happen. If you listen to the media up in Canada, I can almost promise you that they're telling you that if we don't have these police checkpoints, if we don't make sure that you're locked up in your house like a caged animal, then we're going to have body bags lining the streets and the hospitals are going to get overwhelmed. I just don't know how that thought can coexist while there's places like Idaho and there's places like Florida, or parts of Florida at least, where in other, like maybe South Dakota, I don't know some of the other states like that, or Sweden or something, that there's just no compliance. There's no mask wearing. I mean, there's some, but let's just say 5%, something like that. How is it possible? And if the conclusion is, well, maybe this isn't that big of a deal other than for a select group of people that are at high risk. And maybe those people are already just not wanting to go out because they don't want to take risks. Therefore, the people out and about really don't have any risk. Therefore, you're not seeing any. It's not a big deal. And then you have to ask the question, well, then if it's not that big of a deal, and if by the way, if you look at the charts and the data, the mandates and these curfews don't do anything. They don't do anything. So people like to, it makes them feel good that, oh, we're doing something to, hello, we're in a pandemic, dummy. Now we're going to do something because we value lives. We value human life. And we want to be safe. We want to be healthy. Therefore, we're going to institute a curfew and lock you in your house from 10 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning. As though that moves the needle. As though that somehow does something. And when you, and what's ironic is when you look at the data and you see the trends and the trajectories, you see that when they implement a lockdown, as an example, nothing happens. Like there's no correlation between the two. Sometimes it goes down, sometimes it comes shooting up. There's just absolutely no correlation. I just feel sorry for you, Arnold. And one thing, here's looking at the glass half full. Because of what's been going on, I've been doing a ton of research on the Spanish flu. And what were the restrictions? What were the regulations? Were the measures they took back then just as draconian as they are now? But yet, since we've never seen something like this, we just assume that it's unprecedented and we've never done anything like this in the United States. But in reality, is this just something we've already been through? And if that's the case, then you know that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that this isn't going to last forever. In fact, if I had to put money on it and you wanted my prediction as to when the whole hysteria will start to kind of fade away, and I'm not saying be gone completely, but start to settle down a little bit, probably in 2022. Why do I say that? That's pretty simple. If you go back and look at when the Spanish flu started, that was in March of 1918. Oddly enough, the same month. But this time it was just March of 2020. And when did they finally just kind of move on from the Spanish flu? When did the population just kind of start to forget about it? That would have been at the beginning of 1920. So that puts you right about 2 years, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. So I think that at the end of the summer, it'll start to flay. You might have a little bit of a tick up or something like that. That's pretty much what the Spanish flu did. But then by the time you get to the beginning, to the spring of 2022, it's gone. It's out of sight, out of mind. That's what happened with the Spanish flu. So if I had to put money on it, I would say that that's probably what's going to happen here from a societal standpoint. I hope. I mean, but now, the governments have really taken so much more power than they did back then. That's really the wild card. That's the variable that's tough to use any game theory on. Because just as an example, back during the Spanish flu, government spending as a percentage of GDP was probably like 5%, 7%, something like that. Now it's 60%. So that's an apples to oranges comparison. And back then, they didn't have any statewide restrictions. They left it up to the individual mayor of each little city. So as an example, I read that Kansas City had very, very strict measures. Now, they never did a lockdown like we did. But they made people wear masks. And at some places, if you didn't wear a mask, they'd take you to jail. So even more draconian than we have here, other than Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico's like that. They'll probably shoot you if you don't wear a mask. But I'm exaggerating. But Puerto Rico is really, really bad. But Philadelphia was a lot more open. So again, they left it to the mayor. What we've done is we've just, like everything, it's more central planning, it's more government power, more government decisions. So instead of just leaving it to the individual mayors like they did back then, and I don't think they shut down businesses either. I know a couple cities had restrictions on businesses where they would open at revolving hours and whatnot, but I don't think they ever just shut them down. They didn't do lockdowns, forcing people to stay in their house. They didn't do those things, but they did have a mask mandate in a lot of cities. But my point is it was far more decentralized, where now it's much more centralized. Therefore, the government is capturing a lot more power than they had before. Very similar to 2001 and 9/11. And then we got the Patriot Act. And now all of a sudden we've got TSA. I mean, the kids now probably don't even remember. I remember the first flight, or one of the first couple flights I went on as a kid in the 1970s. And, you know, I was born in 73. So this, I think my first flight, I flew at like 5 years old or 6 years old, seven, something like that. Like first, like big commercial flight, maybe 5 years old. And I remember vividly being just getting out of the car and basically like just walking through the airport really quick, getting your ticket, and just hopping on the plane. It was like, there's no TSA. There's no, there's not. I can't even remember if there was a metal detector. I don't recall. Was there even a metal detector? I can't recall. There might not even have been a metal detector. And I also remember vividly that, not to go off on a tangent, but the gals they had working back then on the airlines, that was like an awesome, awesome, awesome job. And you had to be like, you know, you had to be on your A game to be a flight attendant or a stewardess, I think they called them back then. And, you know, you not only had to look a certain way, but you had to be extremely professional. You had to be very polite and accommodating. Now that you get onto a plane and everyone's just yelling at you and barking at you. And I remember I was a flight really hit home that I was on it, this flight attendant or whatever, you know, some gal, it's just being obnoxiously rude. It's you can tell she doesn't want to be there, and she's just treating the customers as though they're a nuisance. You I'm sure you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. And there was this old lady, probably like, I don't know, 75 or something like that. And she's trying to put her bag up there. And the flight attendant just looking at her. Just, yeah. I'm like, dude, are you going to help this gal? I mean, I like got out of my my chair and unbuckled my seatbelt. I'm like, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to help her. I mean, give me a break. And, you know, and I always get pissed off about that. And I'm like, hey, you know, you realize this is your job, right? This is your job, especially with someone who's 75. And I've been kicked off planes before they even take off, where they just eject me right from the plane. They just kick me off the plane flat out and won't even refund me because I get in fights with the flight. You know, the people, they're just idiot. They're just so rude. Big tangent. Bottom line is, and I remember when people used to smoke on the plane. I remember that as a little kid. I remember sitting in the seat right there and looking at the guy in front of me press on the little air thing and just light up and start smoking right on the plane. That is freedom, baby. For better or worse, that is freedom. But you get my point. Now it's just it's gone to where just trying to get on an airplane, you have to get an anal cavity search, and they're, you know, just making you go through these, not just metal detectors, but body scanners and everything. And it's just completely obnoxious. So I guess that's kind of the pessimist side to the optimistic view that although we had the Spanish flu, then we had the 1920s And you don't hear about people wearing masks in the 1920s. So hopefully, once we get into 2022, then we'll see history kind of repeat itself that way. But again, the counter argument to that is that things are much, much different now because we have so much government overreach as is. And what happened in 2020 is a direct reflection of that centralized power and government overreach compared to 1918.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Presuming Lacey Hunt, Brent Johnson, Snyder, Steve are correct about dollar inflation, So dollar, maybe dollar appreciation. Okay. Where is the best place to invest excess cash? T-bills. That's what I would do. It's not investment advice, but I would put them in T-bills, especially if you got over 250. And if you're over that FDIC limit, I think T-bills are the best place to be. Would you consider having Felix? I'm not sure who he is. So, I mean, usually the way I choose who goes on my show is it someone I want to talk to. And if it's someone I want to talk to, usually it's because I already listen to their content and I know who they are. And if I don't already know who they are, then not that this person isn't great. This person could be amazing, but I'll have to hear him like on Real Vision or Macro Voices or something like that before I'd probably reach out to him. I have a maturity annuity of 100K. I'm retired. I would like to pull it out, but not sure where to invest. How would you recommend? I can't get into that too much. What I do is I just have a 10-80-10 strategy. So 10% insurance, which is for me is physical gold, and or the equivalent of that. I haven't been able to buy it lately because I travel so much. So I've been buying Rick's product, Rick Rule with Sprott. And then 80%, what I would define as investments. And that's something that pays you to own it, like a rental property or a dividend paying stock. And then the other 10% would be a speculative asset. So it doesn't necessarily pay you to own it, but I think it's cheap. There's a lot of asymmetry, a lot more upside than there's downside. Bitcoin, uranium, gold miners would be good examples of what I would consider speculative assets. And so that's how I do my portfolio, just to keep it simple. And I think that's my best advice. I have a bit of dry powder. I'm looking at coal, uranium. Sorry, guys, this thing jumped on me. Boy, it's gone. Sorry about that. I think your question was coal, uranium. I mean, I like all those. They shut down that coal ETF, KOL. But if you can get something, I mean, Chris McIntosh always talks about an ETF that he built for our members in Rebel Capitalist Pro. Not literally, but he said, okay, if I was going to create an ETF, these are the stocks that I'd buy. And so if you're a member of Rebel Capitalist Pro, you can just look at those and say, okay, I'll just buy those and kind of pretend it's my own little ETF of coal shares. But especially if they're paying great dividends, I think that's fantastic. That'd be a good investment. Uranium, I'm very, very bullish on uranium. I think it's great as a speculative asset. And I don't know what your other one was, but that's my take on them. What do you think about investing in self-storage? I like that, but the only problem with self-storage is you can get a competitor that just goes right across the street and you can't really move your business. So a lot of CapEx. The thing with residential is you can have an edge. I guess you could kind of have an edge on, but it's tough because what most people don't realize is real estate, you're creating an experience. You're creating a feeling. If you're doing real estate well, even if you're doing residential, like Hartman or myself, or if you're doing like big apartments like Kenny, you're trying to, even when Kenny's doing an apartment complex, or he's got a couple hotels now as well, you're trying to create a lifestyle upgrade. So when someone walks right in the building, they feel like, oh my gosh, wow, I was living in just this little shanty thing or something that was decent, but now I feel like, whoo, I've really made it. And my wife is going to want to show off the kitchen to all of her friends, and I'm going to want to have my buddies over to watch the UFC fight so I can, you know, they can look at this and say, wow, George, you must have got that pay raise, or you must have been doing this. You know, you feel good about yourself because you've been able to buy something, and you're improving your life, and you can tell that just visually. And that's the feeling you're selling. You're not selling a roof over your head. So and that gives you a huge competitive edge. Now, if you're not creating that feeling, then you're not doing it right. And very few people are doing it right. So then your only area in which you can compete is price. And the only way you go is down. And I understand that with a storage unit, you can compete on customer service and some of these other things. But at the end of the day, it's kind of a commodity where you're if some guy moves in across the street, you're just going to have to lower your prices, and it's going to kind of be this race to the bottom, where with an apartment complex or a single family home, there's a lot you can do to set yourself apart from your competitors, even if they're right across the street. From your perspective, possible solutions for this current situation? Solutions with, I think you're asking me solutions where we don't have to go through an incredible amount of economic pain. I do not have a solution like that. Because there's so much malinvestment in the system, because the economy has been so distorted, it's just like the heroin addict. That's the best example I can use. You're asking me if there's a way to get a heroin addict off the drug and get them sober and healthy again without them having to go through withdrawals. The answer is no. Unfortunately, you can't. They, at some point, they've got to go through the hell of their body not having the drug that it's become addicted to the point where it needs it to survive. Our economy is the exact same with QE, with stimulus. And whether that has a direct effect or not, psychologically, in what the decision-making process that people have that are interacting in the economy, it has a tremendous effect. And the asset prices being in bubbles and the distortions. And I mean, you can go down the list of problems that we have with the economy. Right now, the economy is a one-trick pony. It's just like Venezuela. From the standpoint of Venezuela was a one-trick pony with oil. They had all their economic eggs in one basket. And we have all our economic eggs in one basket, the stimulus basket. So you take away the stimulus, and Humpty Dumpty comes crashing down. And there's just no other way around it. At some point in time, you got to pay the fiddler. Why? There's no free lunch. if we just had some smart guy or gal at the Fed or central planner that was just so brilliant, or some AI that someone invented that was just so brilliant that they could just kind of turn this dial over here, do a little QE over there, do a little interest rate manipulation over here, and bam, 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 bam. And it's just kind of you land the plane smoothly, and then we take right off again with real economic growth, and the economy is very stable and fundamentally sound. Then what that means is that we have had a free lunch, and a free lunch exists. I think if you come from a standpoint that there is no free lunch, that's not possible. Therefore, if you have some sort of distortion, you're going to have some sort of downside. At some point, you're going to have to pay the fiddler. I believe that's true. So if you start from that position, then you can answer your own question. If you're asking me what's the solution without any pain, or with very little pain, and honestly, the solution is a depression. That's the solution. The solution to collapse. That's the medicine, ironically enough. But we've presented. See, what happens is obsession is good for the system. It cleans the system out. It's like a forest fire. It makes the system more healthy. But if you avoid the recession, then all of the tinder in the forest, all of the brush, the overgrowth gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until, boom, it blows up and it takes down half the state. Where if you would just allow the nature to take its course and allow that forest fire to clean the system out, it's going to start right back in that cycle, going to happen over again naturally. And you're not going to have much downside in aggregate total over, let's say, a 50-year period or a 100-year period. But what we're doing is we're creating more pain than we otherwise would have to take by all of these artificial measures, you see. So bottom line is that there is a solution to our current situation, and that is a depression. Hopefully 1920-21. Just back government spending, allow interest rates to go up, don't backstop any companies, no bailouts, no nada. And then just let the system flush itself out. It would be catastrophic. You would have unemployment at probably 30-40%. I mean, the standard of living would plummet. And what people want is they want a good solution. But we're at a point where there are no good solutions. The only solution is terrible or horrible. So what do you choose? Choose terrible or horrible, because that's the only solution we have. There are no good solutions, or there are no good options. All right, guys, I've got to get to a member live stream for Rebel Capitalist Pro. I just remind everyone that if you want to go to the Rebel Capitalist live event and actually meet guys like Ken McElroy and Jason Hartman and Jeff Snyder, Brent Johnson, Mark Moss, and gals like Net Zhang and a bunch of other people, other rebel capitalists. And if you want to learn from these individuals and network and really have the opportunity to meet other rebel capitalists and have a great time, a great weekend, and hear some things, some actionable advice that you're just not going to hear anyone else, delivered in a way that's extremely impactful. One thing I learned from my conversation with Jeff today, you guys know I've interviewed several times, and it's one thing to sit there and talk to him over Zoom or like an interact that we're interacting right now, where you can just see me. It's video, so I think it's a lot more impactful, and you learn a lot more than just hearing the audio. But I learned more today, just an hour talking to Jeff, and going back and forth just in a conversational way than I have in the three or four times that I've actually interviewed him. When you see people face to face, it's a completely different dynamic. And I think there's tremendous value in just, I mean, at the end of the day, we're humans, right? We're not meant to see people over Zoom. We're not meant to see people in two-dimensional form on the computer. We're meant to shake people's hands and look them in the eye and to pat them on the back and have a good drink and actually talk to people face to face. That's how we're hardwired. So it just makes sense. That's where we're going to get the most value and learn the most. So check out Rebel Capitalist Live. It's rebelcapitalist.com. All right, let's do some shout outs. Who do we got hanging out then? Pork Barrel Investing in the house. Tango. Where'd Tango go? Tango Bid. Bin. Ashid. Emma Weber. Richard Fernandez. Wow. Hero Gemet. I always try to pronounce these tough names. Hero Gemet. Chu, Hero Gamechu, and I'm sure I'm butchering that, buddy. I apologize. Very cool. I love unique names like that. They're really neat. It's unique for English. Legacies, DeFi Dad, S. Agoro, All Nighter Hider, Suzanne the Patriot, Thomas Von Dielzeski. No, I'm not really butchering that. Thomas Von Dielzeski, Daniel J, Chris Frank, Becky B, Scott Horeca, Believe Yourself, there you go, Legacies, oh, I think I got that one. All right, guys, I'm going to shoot over to the live stream, member live stream. I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.